From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Protesters carrying anti-capitalist and pro-refugee signs fought with police in Berlin at the ongoing Blockupy rally. A number of arrests were reported. RT's Peter Oliver filed this report from Germany's capital, Berlin.
The demonstration here has been legitimized. The law in Germany says that if you get over a certain amount of people coming out onto the streets, it becomes a legal demonstration. That wasn't the case a little earlier on. What happened once police said that you weren't allowed to stray from that area? Well, the protesters decided it was time to stray. They moved off in different directions. That's why they're split around the city. We also heard that police deployed batons as well as pepper spray in some areas. We were caught up in a bit of the melee. The police had told demonstrators that they were only allowed to stay on this side of the road here at Potsdamer Platz, right slam bang in the centre of the German capital. The demonstrators tried to move across the road. The police are now creating a barricade, and if we move over this way, keeping people off the main road. Okay, we're going to get off that road as well to make sure we're not in violation of the police. Well, it's a far more peaceful scene right now. Demonstrators coming not just from Germany but also from other parts of Europe. One of the main messages amongst these anti-capitalist demonstrators is being the fact that what they see is that the policies made don't just affect Germany, they affect Europe as a whole.
Brazil's ousted President Dilma Rousseff is appealing her impeachment by the country's Senate. Journalist Marcelo Sanchez, who covers Latin American affairs, in an interview with Press TV, was asked if he thought Rousseff's characterization of her impeachment as a coup was accurate.
It's a sharp contrast between 1992 when Collor de Mello was impeached because he received accusations of personal enrichment. Now, Dilma Rousseff never take advantage of the government or the presidency in order to increase her fortune or get involved in corruption. More than 60, some sources say 80% of legislators involved in the impeachment against Dilma Rousseff are, and it's confirmed, they are involved in corruption scandals. Lava Jato is still not clear. Michel Temer himself, it's part of this whole dramatic history of corruption in the Brazilian politics. Now, let's talk about the media in Brazil. This is part of the corporate establishment as well. And when you see those polls saying that, oh, and 49%, 60% of Brazilian citizens wanted her to leave the government, they wanted her to be impeached. Well, this is something that we get in the West through the media establishment, the corporations, but the media in Brazil is controlled by the same people that ousted President Dilma Rousseff, and that they were against Lula da Silva, the Partido dos Trabajadores, and they were against social measures from her government. They are just, they just keep working for their own enrichment. Let's just remember that Brazil has probably the third largest economy in Latin America, and also they have resources, oil. It's a major thing that nobody's saying right now, neither in Brazil, neither you hear this in the US through the news. But the reality is that in the long term, they do want to get into the government, stay in the government, take all the resources and increase their corporate power by becoming a huge bureaucracy, technocracy, actually, like some other analysts were saying earlier.
With the FBI revelations that hackers have targeted voter registration systems in Arizona and Illinois, and with a new document dump that Guccifer 2.0 said he hacked from computers of congressional Democrats, Democratic Party leaders are placing the blame on Russia and trying to tie their critics to Moscow. Ring of Fire radio host Mike Papantonio discussed with RT America the Democratic Party establishment's new McCarthyism.
What Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi are doing right now is not only dishonest, it's dangerous. Scaring the American public into believing that the Russian government is trying to hack into our emails, hack into our election system is absolute fiction. This Guccifer. Now, can you imagine Harry Reid making the leap, the letter that he wrote to the FBI saying, we're at great risk. It is all supposition. There is not one iota of proof of anything. But now to shift it and say this new McCarthyism, this crazy radical talk that we're hearing from Reid and Pelosi, they're out there with this new brand of McCarthyism because they think it's a good distraction. In other words, don't pay attention to the content that was hacked from the DNC emails, the content that showed Debbie Wasserman Schultz was trying to undermine Bernie Sanders' campaign. Don't pay attention to the content. Let's talk about the Russian boogeyman and where it came from. First of all, there's absolutely no proof that this Guccifer that Reid is out talking about has any connection at all to organized government in Russia. This is extremely dangerous. It's scaremongering from the Republicans. We used to expect this all the time. But now the Democrats, they want to do this because they want to tie Donald Trump to Vladimir Putin as if anybody really cares. Here's the problem. People trying to launch this new Cold War with Russia are the ones who grew up during the actual Cold War, during McCarthyism. The new generation, millennials, they don't feel the same way about Russia. So this is a ridiculous argument for some millennial who's 25 years old. He's listening. So what? Russia is part. We've been allies with Russia in so many things. And now just to get Clinton as a distraction, to distract issues away from Clinton, to distract issues away from the DNC, we have this full-out attack, McCarthy-type attack on the Russian government, and what their goal is, if you really take a look at it, they're ignoring the idea that it's inviting a new Cold War that we've finally got rid of. We finally passed that's in the history books, and millennials, they're looking at this saying, really, Harry Reid, really, Nancy Pelosi, what in the world are you talking about?
One of the major historical contradictions, though, with the new Cold War is the fact that it's being blamed on the ultra-right, or alt-right as it's called, being led by Russia. This was Hillary Clinton in 1998 when her husband was under attack for the Lewinsky affair.
The great story here for anybody willing to find it and write about it and explain it is this vast right-wing conspiracy that has been conspiring against my husband since the day he announced for president.
In this recent clip, she makes it clear that she still believes that conspiracy exists.
Do you still believe there's a vast right-wing conspiracy?
Don't you?
I'm asking you.
Yeah.
And who's behind it all?
The grand godfather of this global brand of extreme nationalism is Russian President Vladimir Putin.
For more on that and other national and international issues, or both, we spoke with the Green Party's vice presidential candidate, Ajamu Baraka, Monday. Ajamu Baraka, vice presidential candidate of the Green Party, it's a pleasure to speak with you.
Don, it's really, really a pleasure to be with you on this very, very important show. Thank you.
Thank you. So they say you might be a heartbeat away from the presidency, and certainly this year, the Green Party, the Libertarian Party, are getting numbers that they've never seen before, and there's a 20-something percent steady polling number of people that will not vote for Trump or Clinton still showing up. If you end up in the White House, what would you, sitting from that chair, looking out, what would you change, and what would you start working on?
Well, Don, that's a very good question. And as you indicated in your question, I mean, there is great dissatisfaction in this country regarding the two parties. It seems that people are really beginning to wake up to this two-party monopoly and the narrow interests that they both represent. And for the first time, it appears that the politics of fear-mongering, while they have been somewhat effective, they have not been as effective in the past. And people are taking a look at third-party alternatives and taking a serious look at our campaign and the kinds of issues that we represent and the analysis that we have been attempting to try to advance regarding issues of militarism and war and interventions and all of that. So this has been a very historic moment that we really feel grateful to be a part of and hope to try to help to continue to facilitate. You know, if we win, of course, that would represent a significant change in the consciousness of this country. You know, we say that basically, if we win, this will be not an end point, but a beginning point in terms of the politics that we're trying to advance. We have no illusions about what we can do, having nominal control of an aspect of the state. We recognize that in order for us to continue to try to make some progressive change, we have to have, in a real way, we have to have a energized a social movement behind us, or social movements, if you will. And that is that one of the aspects of this campaign is basically to try to help to galvanize the various social movements into a left or radical bloc, social bloc, if you will. And for that social bloc not to demobilize at the end of the election, but to remain mobilized. We have pledged, Don, that basically, you know, we're not going to, you know, we're not interested in politics as usual. We don't want demobilization. We don't want disempowerment. But because, again, we understand that for the radical change that has to take place in this country, it has to be based on the people, and it has to be something that's coordinated and sustained. And so, you know, we want that to continue. Now, our concerns, Don, is that, you know, in this conversation that we are involved in and the other two parties, your question indicates a very serious absence, and that is not a lot of conversation has taken place regarding U.S. foreign policies. One of the things that I know that we would do if we were elected is that we would use the enormous power of this state to engage in what Jill Stein calls a peace offensive, and that is to basically attempt to de-escalate the tensions in places like this, like the so-called Middle East. We would withdraw support for the notion of regime change in these various countries, because that is fundamentally imperialist. It does not represent our commitment to understanding that that national sovereignty is important, and that self-determination is important, and that whatever changes take place within a particular nation state has to be internal to that nation state. So we would withdraw U.S. Interventions. We would begin a process of using the power of the state to, in fact, facilitate processes of national reconciliation in various parts of the world. We would put a halt to the expansion of AFRICOM on the African continent, because we see that in every place we've seen an intervention, we've seen an expansion of the influence of this military structure. An interesting thing has always happened. There's been an uptick in radical jihadist activity.
Yeah, isn't that an interesting thing?
we would bring about some real fundamental changes in terms of how we use state power and how we would relate to various states and the various peoples around the world.
You know, one of the things that really struck me that drove home the point of the I would say unusual reconfiguration of the existing electorate was there were two moments, one at the Republican convention first and then one at the Democratic convention. And the one at the Republican convention was when Trump said that he was going to put an end to nation building and regime change, over. Mm-hmm. And the assembled Republican Party base, you know, all the district leaders and all the people, the county executives and everybody that show up at these conventions, stood up. They gave him a standing ovation over that point. And I'm saying to myself, this is the Republican Party, and this is the base. Meanwhile, at the Democratic convention, when there were a series of speakers, but Leon Panetta most notably, when he spoke, the Sanders people, presumably that's who it was certainly a heavy overlap with them, were standing up saying no more war, and they got shouted down by chance from Clinton supporters of USA. And I just looked and said, wow, things have very changed a lot in a very short period of time.
Yes. So you're absolutely right. I think the other pivotal moment for me with the Republican convention and the discussions leading up to that convention was the fact that Donald Trump not only said what he said in terms of questioning what was sort of the orthodoxy in terms of Republican positions on nation building and interventions and the role of NATO and all of that was when he said that the Republican Party was going to be transformed into a working class party.
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah.
And I think the contrast was quite significant for many people with the Democrats, that basically the Democrats and the realignment that's taken place with significant elements of the neocon element moving to the Democrats, at least for this election, it does indicate a possibly a real realignment that's more permanent. But it does indicate, it did expose the ideological, the bipartisan ideological commitment to the transnational elite agenda. That what really concerns the elite in the U.S., the transnational elite, is not Trump's racism and xenophobia. We all know that that's been a fundamental part of Republican politics for quite some time. What they're concerned about is the unpredictability of Trump's positions on the what has become the common sense position of the transnational elite, their commitment to neoliberal capitalist expansion, and their commitment to maintaining their hegemony globally. And so when he questions the role of NATO, when he talks about, it takes policies that seem to undermine the authority and the legality of the World Trade Organization, where he stands opposed to the TPP and all the other so-called free trade agreements, he becomes a real serious threat to this economic elite. And that's why they're concerned. They can live with the other stuff. They're concerned about that. And that's why there's been this political alignment taking place. But what's interesting about this, Don, is that progressives and even some radicals don't seem to see what is in fact going on. And now they are, even with this alignment, the realignment taking place in the Democratic Party, they seem to be comfortable with the fact that their standing with the Democrats is even more tenuous, that they are even less needed than before, So I don't understand why they, will allow themselves to be manipulated in this fear-mongering and they're taking positions opposed to the Green Party's bid to try to offer an alternative, offer a choice, and instead withstand with the Democrats and allow themselves to be used in this sort of hysteria that's been built up around what Trump is supposed to be about. And that's saying that Trump doesn't represent serious dark forces. He does. But, we've got to differentiate and draw the differences between what Trump represents and what the neoliberal line represents, and how that impacts on poor and working class people and our movement building activities here in the U.S.
Yeah, you have a very unusual alliance right now in the Clinton campaign. I would say, I don't know if it's within the Democratic Party, but the most recent announcement, for example, of 150 Republican officials are endorsing Hillary Clinton. The movement essentially of the entire party, the top level party apparatus, that with some exceptions that were the source of all of these concepts that were involved in U.S. elections, racist concepts, xenophobic concepts, Islamophobic concepts, anti-immigrant concepts, all of these things, the Democrats would point to the Republicans. They were pointing to these Republicans who are now in their tent. The people that were organized to oppose that, who represent the Democratic constituency, are now under the same tent with them. It obviously can't hold. So maybe it can hold till the election, but at some point in time, they're going to go. Now, you're saying essentially that it's the Democratic constituency that can be cut loose as being unneeded. So what do they do looking at the landscape right now?
Well, that is a good question, and I suspect that based on conversations with many people who are still attempting to operate within the context of the Democratic Party, they are appalled by what they are seeing, but they are still afraid to break. I mean, you know, objectively, Don, these folks are politicians who run, you know, within the Democratic Party apparatus. And they know that if they step out, that there's going to be some serious consequences. Many of them are not prepared to do that. It reminds me, for example, you've been around long enough. You remember that, you know, in 83, 84, when Jesse made his first run, you know, the entire Democratic apparatus, black folks included, you know, basically tried to ignore it. And he wasn't able to garner much support within the Democratic apparatus. Right. Not saying that people didn't support it, but they weren't willing to step out. And you saw that there was a big difference in 87, 88. And significant numbers of folks, you know, black folks, you know, and others, you know, stepped out and expressed support for Jesse. So, you know, once they saw that there was some momentum, then they, you know, these folks had got a little bit of a backbone and tried to step out. I suspect, Don, the same things are happening with the realignments taking place right now politically, that, you know, these folks, you know, are not prepared to step out yet by themselves, but if they see the momentum that we are building with this third party challenge, and we are able to get ballot access and populate the down ticket with credible candidates, you know, if we get that 5%, you know, and more, I think that after this election, I think people may be willing to step out and begin to engage a more progressive kind of politics, at least if you're going to participate in the electoral process. You know, we need to have some kind of third-party alternative. I think people are looking at this now for the first time in a very serious way.
And, you know, of course, the scare tactic that's used is and being used heavily, perhaps in an unprecedented way this time, is if you vote for Jill Stein or Gary Johnson, for that matter, or Monica Moorhead or Gloria LaRiva, a vote for any of those means that you're electing Donald Trump. And that is such a scary thing compared to what a Clinton presidency would be, that it has to be the primary objective. How do you deal with that question?
Well, it is a we deal with that question by basically reminding people that, you know, you look at what's in the queue on the Republican side, and basically it suggests that this scare tactic every 4 years is going to continue. So the question becomes among, at least in particular among progressives and radicals, is when do we draw a line and begin to build alternatives? And you're going to, you know, either you decide you're not going to, you know, mess with electoral politics at all, and many people have opted for that, and that's a legitimate position. But for the millions that do participate, and if you are involved in the electoral process, then the question becomes, do you continue to allow yourself to be manipulated by the politics of fear? You know, the other part of that I find interesting, too, Don, is that, you know, the American presidency is still not yet a dictatorship. I mean, of course, you know, that position has been gathering more and more power. But it's like people forget about the people. And that is that, you know, if a Trump was to win or whatever, that basically there's still the power of the people to oppose. You know, we were told in 2004, you know, vote or die. You know, that basically a second term of George Bush was basically going to be the end of the world. You know, we survived, you know, and we will survive anybody else who might win that office. The point here is this. There's going to be change in this country, and we got to determine whether or not that change continues to move toward the right, or are we able to affect change that is going to be progressive and grounded in the needs and aspirations of the people. Okay? That means we got to struggle. If people are afraid to struggle, if people are afraid, that's fine. Just get out of the way, though. Get out of the way. Keep your mouth shut, okay? And don't oppose those of us who understand what the historical moment requires.
And, you know, looking at the objective condition at a macro God's eye view, and looking at it from a class perspective, the one of the problems that's evident in the electoral map, I would say, is one manifestation, certainly, is the divisions among the workers, the division of the working class. And, you know, to a degree, Trump has already made the Republican Party a workers' party for a segment of the working class, that being the white working class, the post-industrial working class, and the unemployed industrial working class, I would say, in some places, and also policy-wise, for a lot of black workers in places like Detroit as well. If those jobs come back, those former UAW workers are back on the line, if that's possible. But, you know, there is such a division among the working class, particularly over the issue of race, which has been our historic fault. How would you assemble that in a post-election scenario? Whether Clinton or Trump wins, you're going to have this underdevelopment, reconfiguration of the political structures. How would you strive towards working class unity?
Well, that is a very that is, in fact, has always been the challenge of the moment, because as you indicated, race has been the Achilles heel of the progressive movement in this country, and in fact is now we're seeing that across the Western world. You know, we have to first thing we have to do is basically allow for those elements of the working class, black folks, Latinos, who are engaged in self-organization to organize themselves, and that engage in the class reductionism. We want to bring in the class element. That's absolutely important. But we've got to take a serious look at what's being framed as so-called identity politics, and understand what are some of the contradictions of it, but also what are some of the reasons why we have so-called identity politics, if you will. Secondly, you know, regardless whether anyone thinks that it is worth the expenditure of effort, we've got to have a politics in this country in which we're able to have language and ability to speak to the objective concerns and realities of white workers. No one, Don, really speaks to their efforts, it appears. The only ones seem to be speaking to them in a sustained way are elements of the far right. You know, so that work is an area of work that has not received the kind of attention that is needed for quite some time, even within, for example, the labor unions. I mean, because it has not been a serious attempt to deal with the issue of white supremacist ideology, among white workers, even in the labor unions, you know, you have a real backwardness when it comes to understanding of race. So, you know, we're not going to be able to build and sustain a progressive movement in this country as long as we are afraid to deal with all aspects, all components of white supremacist ideology, you know, and have a serious confrontation. I don't like that word of conversation. You know, we have engagement with people, and that's good. But we got to confront this thing and deal with it. So, you know, how we deal with those dark forces after the election, you know, we have to, that remains to be seen. But it's clear that we have to. That Trumpism, win or lose, is not going away. And so we have got to be able to have a language and an approach. And we've seen that happen before. We've seen even in the history of black opposition, you know, in places like Chicago, and the Rainbow Coalition that was organized by Fred Hampton and the Black Panther Party, you know, that basically there's a language and an approach that can be successful in building across racial divisions and having those grounded in a real integrated and accepted connection between race and class. And that kind of political education, those kinds of that kind of building has to be part of a progressive agenda here in this country. We can't hide from it. And white progressives can no longer be allowed to escape responsibility for organizing in working class white communities.
Thank you very much, Ijeoma Baraka, vice presidential candidate of the Green Party, a noted columnist at BlackAgendaReport.com, and a human rights activist. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.